Welcome to the Lowdown. This is an AI-generated open-source news summary for general informational awareness. This product is not intended for use as official intelligence. The views expressed here are solely those of the cited authors and do not reflect the official policy or position of the Department of War, the United States Air Force, or any other U.S. government agency.
U.S. and Iranian forces are engaged in a rapidly escalating kinetic exchange across the Middle East following the resumption of the U.S. naval blockade, with strikes expanding into inland Iran and Iranian retaliatory attacks on U.S. regional bases. Concurrently, Russian forces have resumed a targeted strike campaign against Ukrainian Black Sea port infrastructure and commercial shipping to degrade Ukraine's export capacity. In the Indo-Pacific, the People's Liberation Army continues rapid hardware expansion and strategic technological development, despite facing severe internal leadership instability due to widespread anti-corruption purges.
All right, welcome in, everyone. So you just heard the top-line brief there, but what does it actually mean when the world's most critical waterways basically turn into active war zones overnight?
Yeah, it's a lot to unpack.
Right. Today, we're taking a deep dive into the open source intelligence to understand exactly how these global choke points are being squeezed and, you know, more importantly, why. We've got a huge stack of reporting today from the War Zone, AP News, the Institute for the Study of War, and the China Aerospace Studies Institute.
And our mission today is really to connect the dots between these maritime blockades in the Middle East, the scorched earth tactics in Ukraine, and this massive, chaotic leadership purge happening right now inside China's military.
Exactly. It's a really complex picture. So let's just jump right into the most active kinetic theater right now, which is the Persian Gulf.
Right.
The interim U.S.-Iran ceasefire has entirely broken down. I mean, according to reporting from the War Zone and AP News, on July 14th, 2026, the United States reimposed a naval blockade on Iranian ports. And this isn't just like a line drawn on a map.
No, not at all.
Central Command, or CNTCOM, has over 20 U.S. Navy warships and hundreds of military aircraft operating in the region to enforce this. That is just a staggering logistical footprint.
It really is. Mm-hmm. I mean, maintaining a blockade of that magnitude requires immense coordination. You're talking constant radar coverage, airspace management, surface patrols, the works.
And as we mentioned, it is actively kinetic.
Yeah, meaning forces are engaging in live combat.
Yeah.
AP News and the War Zone documented a very specific, I'd say highly illustrative, interdiction involving an oil tanker called the MT Belma.
Okay, what happened there?
Well, it's a Curacao-flagged vessel. It was unladen, meaning it was empty of oil at the time, and it was ignoring multiple warnings while transiting toward Iran's Karg Island oil terminal.
Right, and the response from the U.S. wasn't to board it or, you know, try to sink it. CNTCOM reported that a U.S. aircraft fired Hellfire missiles directly into the ship's smokestack.
Right.
I want to pause on that for a second because it's such a specific tactical choice. Why aim for the smokestack?
It's a precision disabling strike.
Uh-huh.
See, if you breach the hull of an oil tanker, even an unladen one, which, by the way, still carries massive amounts of heavy fuel oil just for its own engines, you risk a catastrophic environmental disaster.
Oh, right. Which would be a nightmare.
Exactly. That would shut down the waterway for everyone and hurt your own strategic interests. So by putting a Hellfire missile, which is a highly precise, relatively low-yield weapon, straight down the smokestack, you destroy the propulsion system.
So it's basically dead in the water.
Yeah, you render the ship completely dead in the water without actually sinking it. It sends a very clear, forceful message without crossing the line into causing an ecological crisis.
That makes a lot of sense. Meanwhile, Iran isn't just sitting back, right? The Institute for the Study of War, or ISW, notes that Iran has attacked at least three commercial vessels, including two Emirati tankers.
Yeah, the reporting notes these vessels were attempting what they call shuttle runs along the Omani coast. They were using alternative traffic separation schemes.
Can you translate that for us? What exactly is a shuttle run in this context?
Sure. So a traffic separation scheme is essentially the highway lane system of the ocean. In the Strait of Hormuz, the standard inbound and outbound lanes often pass through, or at least very close to, Iranian territorial waters. What these Emirati tankers are doing with a shuttle run is hugging the Omani coast as tightly as possible, utilizing localized non-standard routes. Think of it as like taking the back roads to avoid a highway toll booth.
And Iran isn't like that.
Iran is using military force to deter these specific back road routes. Because if ships successfully bypass those main lanes, Tehran loses its leverage and its ability to exert full control over that maritime traffic.
So Iran attacks these ships and in response CNTCOM launches multiple waves of strikes. The war zone and AP News report initial U.S. targets included Greater Tomb Island.
Right.
And for context, that is a heavily militarized rocky island right near the Strait of Hormuz that Iran basically uses as a forward garrison.
Right.
So it makes sense to hit it if you're protecting local shipping.
Exactly. It's a direct tactical response.
But here's where it gets really interesting and honestly a bit alarming. The target list expanded rapidly. AP News and ISW are reporting U.S. strikes hitting targets roughly 200 kilometers inland.
Yes, the geographic shift here is critical. They struck sites in Semnan province, which is well known as the beating heart of Iran's space and ballistic missile programs.
Wow.
Yeah. And additionally, Iranian state media confirmed strikes on the Artesh Ground Forces 388th Mechanized Assault Brigade barracks in Iranshahr. That's located deep in Sistan and Balochistan province.
Okay, let's unpack this strategic shift. Because going from postal enforcement, you know, hitting a garrison island in the strait to protect tankers, to striking a mechanized brigade 200 kilometers deep inland feels like a massive escalation.
It absolutely is.
Based on the intelligence, does this indicate a shift in U.S. operational objectives? Like, are we moving from localized maritime denial into broader regime degradation?
Well, I mean, that is the central question here. The analytical consensus from the ISW interprets these inland strikes as a calculated campaign to degrade the broader military capabilities that facilitate those threats against commercial vessels.
So treating the disease, not the symptoms.
Precisely. Striking 200 kilometers inland demonstrates an intent to neutralize the source of the threat, rather than just playing whack-a-mole with missile launchers deployed on the coastline.
Right.
However, as you'd expect, Iran is retaliating. We are seeing a cascade effect. The war zone and ISW report Iranian drone and missile launches directed at U.S. bases.
Right, including the Al-Azraq facility in Jordan.
Yeah, and locations in Kuwait, Bahrain, and Erbil.
And there are verbal threats too, right? Colonel Ibrahim Zulfagari, a spokesperson for the Iranian military's central headquarters, issued a direct threat to target broad regional infrastructure if U.S. strikes extend to things like power plants or bridges.
Exactly. And this kinetic exchange is being mirrored by a massive economic pressure campaign. ISW reports the U.S. Treasury sanctioned over 50 individuals, entities, and vessels tied to Mohammad Hossein Shamkhani's network.
And that's a shadow economy network, right?
Yeah, they're deeply involved in oil smuggling and sanctions evasion. It generates tens of billions of dollars, which directly funds regional proxy actors like the Houthis.
So it's a full spectrum squeeze. And internally, Iran is maneuvering to lock things down. Anti-regime Kurdish groups claim Iran has deployed 3,000 Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, special forces armor, artillery, drones to the Iraqi Kurdistan border.
Right, they're shoring up their flanks.
And politically, their parliament is reviewing a bill to formally claim control over the Strait of Hormuz.
Which is mostly symbolic, honestly. But it provides them domestic legal cover for their aggressive actions in the Strait.
It is fascinating that Iran's primary leverage against the U.S. blockade is threatening global commerce. And, you know, if we connect this to the bigger picture and look at the Black Sea right now, Russia is quite literally lifting a page from that exact same playbook against Ukraine.
The parallels are striking. According to July 15th reporting from ISW, Russian forces have resumed a heavy targeted strike campaign against Ukrainian port infrastructure along the Black Sea coast.
And the tactical focus here isn't necessarily military, right? It's entirely economic. ISW reports strikes at the Odessa City port and Kornomorsk port that damaged massive amounts of civilian infrastructure.
Yeah, and to give you a sense of the scale, Colonel Holding, they're a Ukrainian grain exporter, reported the destruction of 25,000 tons of sunflower oil.
That is just unbelievable.
For a wartime economy, agricultural exports are the absolute lifeblood. That isn't collateral damage. That is pure economic starvation.
Exactly. And the targeting of the vessels themselves is highly deliberate. Three merchant ships operating under neutral flags, specifically Tanzanian, Liberian, and Marshall Islands flagged vessels, were hit during these strikes in Odessa.
And those are flags of convenience.
Right. So why hit them?
By hitting these neutral ships, Russia is targeting the international insurance market. If maritime insurers believe the Black Sea is too dangerous, they pull coverage. And without insurance, commercial ships simply will not sail.
Ah, so it achieves a de facto blockade without needing a massive naval presence.
Exactly, which is critical because Russia's naval presence has been severely degraded. ISW notes this port strike campaign is likely a direct response to Ukraine's ongoing and highly successful long-range drone strikes against Russian naval vessels.
Right. Ukraine just recently hit a Russian vessel docked all the way in the Sea of Azov in occupied Mariupol.
Yeah. But while the maritime domain is highly dynamic, the ground campaign in Ukraine tells a story of grinding attrition. ISW reporting from July 14th and 15th indicates Russian ground advances remain minimal.
Yeah, Ukrainian officers around Kostyantynivka report that Russian forces haven't been able to seize the city. Instead, they are reverting to scorched earth tactics.
Right. The intelligence mentions the use of glide bombs, multiple launch rocket systems, and small infantry infiltration groups.
Can you explain the mechanics of this for a second? Why the heavy reliance on glide bombs if they aren't actually gaining ground?
Well, a glide bomb is essentially a traditional, unguided, heavy explosive that has been retrofitted with wings and a basic guidance kit. It allows Russian aircraft to release these massive bombs from dozens of kilometers away, keeping the planes safely outside the range of Ukrainian air defenses.
Okay, so they're staying out of harm's way.
Exactly. They are incredibly difficult to intercept, and they cause absolute devastation. So instead of a coordinated combined arms maneuver to capture a city intact, Russia is using glide bombs and artillery to simply flatten the infrastructure while sending small, expendable infantry groups to probe for weaknesses.
Maximizing destruction while minimizing their own vulnerability.
Exactly.
You know, analyzing the maritime intelligence from both theaters, I want to pose a question about the broader strategic implications here. We have Russia intentionally striking neutral-flagged civilian vessels in Odessa. On the exact same day, we have Iran striking commercial shipping in the Strait of Hormuz.
Right.
Wait, so are we seeing a coordinated global normalization of targeting commercial maritime traffic by these state actors? Like, are they coordinating this over a red phone, or is this just a grim coincidence?
It's a great question. Based purely on the open source intelligence provided, there is no evidence of direct operational coordination between Moscow and Tehran regarding these specific maritime strikes. It is highly unlikely there's a red phone coordinating this.
Okay, so more of a coincidence.
Well, it indicates a shared tactical evolution. Both nations recognize that global supply chains are incredibly fragile. In the Black Sea, Russia is attempting to sever Ukraine's economic umbilical cord to the rest of the world. In the Strait of Hormuz, Iran is using the threat to global energy markets to generate leverage and counteract the U.S. naval blockade.
Right.
The cumulative effect, regardless of explicit coordination, is a severe degradation of international maritime security norms. When neutral ships are considered valid targets in multiple theaters simultaneously, the fundamental rules of global trade begin to unravel.
That is a sobering reality. Now, transitioning from these active kinetic choke points, we need to shift our focus to the Indo-Pacific.
Yeah, this is a really important pivot.
We are tracking a fascinating and systemic development within the People's Liberation Army, or PLA. We are looking at a stark, glaring contradiction: rapid external hardware expansion happening at the exact same time as severe internal leadership instability.
It's a wild contrast.
Let's start with the hardware, because the numbers are just huge. The War Zone is reporting that production of the PLA's Chengdu J-20 Mighty Dragon stealth fighter has scaled incredibly fast.
Yeah, the scale of production is fundamentally altering the regional balance of air power. According to the analysis, J-20 production reached approximately 300 airframes by late 2025.
And they know that for sure.
Yeah, they actually confirmed this by identifying serial number CB10300 on an airframe, which designates the 300th jet from their 10th production batch. And as of mid-2026, defense analysts estimate that number has surged to roughly 500 airframes.
When you hear 500 airframes, it might just sound like a big number, but let's contextualize the operational impact for everyone. The War Zone notes that the J-20 fleet now numerically outnumbers the U.S. Air Force's combat-coded F-22 Raptor fleet.
Right.
And combat-coded is the key phrase there. What does that actually mean for the listener?
So combat-coded means those specific aircraft are fully equipped, loaded with the latest software, assigned to active squadrons with trained pilots, and are ready to fly a combat mission today.
Okay, so not in the shop.
Exactly. They aren't in a depot for maintenance, and they aren't being used exclusively for training. The U.S. has a total of 185 F-22s, but only 143 of them are combat-coded.
Wow.
So the PLA having 500 operational J-20s represents a massive numerical advantage in fifth-generation fighter capability.
And they are fully integrating them. The PLA has inducted the J-20 into all five of its theater commands, pushing out older airframes like the J-7s and J-8s. It is a massive modernization success story on the surface.
On the surface, yes.
But here is where it gets really complicated. This hardware expansion is occurring against a backdrop of unprecedented internal chaos. A July 2026 report from the China Aerospace Studies Institute, or ASI, details extensive anti-corruption purges that have effectively gutted the PLA's high command.
It's incredible. The data shows over 100 two-star and three-star officers have been removed since 2022.
Just gone.
Gone. And the sheer seniority of the personnel being removed cannot be overstated. The CSI report highlights ongoing investigations into Zhang Yuxia, the first vice chairman of the Central Military Commission, and Liu Zhenli, the chief of the Joint Staff Department.
And the Central Military Commission is the absolute highest military authority in China.
Exactly. Its core leadership has been reduced from 7 members in 2023 down to just 2 members in 2026.
The impact on readiness has to be catastrophic. I mean, CSI estimates a turnover rate of 41% to 94% in the top 24 critical PLA three-star roles over the past year alone. Think about that. Up to 94% of their top generals gone.
Yeah.
So essentially, China just built 500 brand new Ferraris, but they just fired all their licensed drivers because they caught them stealing from the company vault.
That's a great way to put it. And alongside these confirmed removals, the intelligence notes unverified rumors circulating, like the rumored sinking of a new Zhu-class nuclear submarine during sea trials and alleged design flaws in a new aircraft carrier.
Right. And we should be clear here.
Yes, it is important to flag that those specific hardware failures remain unverified open source claims. We don't know for sure. However, the fact that these rumors are proliferating speaks to the chaotic environment within the PLA's acquisition and leadership structures. When you have 94% turnover at the three-star level, you lose all institutional knowledge regarding joint operations and complex logistics.
Despite this institutional chaos, their focus on future technology seems entirely rigid. A separate KSI publication analyzed translated documents referred to as Thoughts from the Chairman, which outlines China's 2035 goals for high-level technological self-reliance.
Right.
The focal point is quantum technology, which they call the new strategic high ground.
Yeah, the source outlines 3 specific pillars of this quantum strategy, and it is vital to understand the mechanisms of why this matters. First, they want independent quantum communications, both terrestrial and space-based.
Okay, how does that work?
Quantum communication uses the principles of quantum mechanics to secure data. If a third party tries to intercept or observe the data stream, the physical state of the particles changes, instantly alerting the sender and corrupting the intercepted data. It is, theoretically, an uncrackable communication network, which guarantees absolute digital sovereignty.
That is massive for military command and control. What are the other 2 pillars?
The second is advancing quantum computing to achieve breakthroughs in core technologies, fundamentally breaking their reliance on external Western tech ecosystems.
Makes sense.
And third, developing quantum sensing. Quantum sensors are hypersensitive devices that measure minute changes in gravity or magnetic fields. In a military context, a highly advanced quantum sensor could theoretically detect a submerged stealth submarine by sensing the tiny gravitational anomaly it creates while moving through the water.
This sounds like science fiction.
It does, but the document emphasizes integrating all these capabilities across civil and military sectors by 2035.
This presents a glaring contradiction for anyone analyzing this intelligence. On one hand, you have external hardware success, 500 operational J-20 stealth fighters, and a highly organized 2035 quantum advancement roadmap. On the other hand, you have internal institutional chaos with a near-total decapitation of three-star leadership.
Right.
If we look at these 2 factors, which metric, the hardware scale or the leadership continuity, historically dictates the operational timeline for milestones like the PLA's publicly stated 2027 modernization goals, how does this actually impact their ability to fight in the near future?
Well, the CSI analysis addresses this directly. The short-term effect of removing over 100 flag officers is undeniably a severe reduction in immediate operational readiness. A lack of continuity breeds organizational paralysis. I mean, subordinates become terrified to make decisions lest they be caught in the next wave of purges.
Obviously, you don't want to stick your neck out.
Exactly. However, the report also suggests that in the long term, purging corrupt officers or those who mismanage procurement could ultimately streamline and professionalize the force. Hardware scale, like the 500 J-20s, provides the physical capability to project power. But without experienced, stable leadership to manage complex joint operations, you know, coordinating air, sea, land, and cyber assets simultaneously, the utility of that hardware is severely limited.
Right.
Therefore, while the physical hardware ensures the PLA remains a formidable threat, The extreme leadership instability strongly suggests that fully achieving integrated combat-ready modernization by their 2027 milestone will be severely complicated and likely delayed by this internal friction.
That is going to be something we have to keep an incredibly close eye on.
Absolutely. And, you know, to conclude this briefing, it is essential to synthesize the operational significance of these developments. Global security is currently defined by near-simultaneous active threats to critical maritime choke points.
Yeah.
In the Strait of Hormuz, direct kinetic exchanges between the U.S. and Iran are attempting to dictate the flow of international energy markets and enforce or break a blockade. In the Black Sea, Russian strikes on neutral vessels and agricultural port infrastructure aim to systematically starve Ukraine's export economy.
It's a squeeze everywhere.
It is. These immediate kinetic vulnerabilities in the global supply chain are unfolding alongside a profound strategic shift in the Indo-Pacific, where the PLA is fielding advanced fifth-generation aircraft at an unprecedented scale, while simultaneously undergoing the most severe destabilizing leadership purge in its modern history.
This combination of kinetic maritime interdiction and long-term strategic realignment requires continuous monitoring. As you process the intelligence we've unpacked today, consider this final analytical trajectory. Given the increasing reliance by the United States and its allies on advanced economic sanctions, targeted military blockades, and precision strikes against state and non-state actors alike, we are likely accelerating adversarial efforts to bypass these Western mechanisms entirely.
Yeah, that's a huge point.
Consider how these compounding global pressures may force adversaries to develop completely parallel, sanction-proof logistical and financial systems by 2030. That is a development that wouldn't just challenge Western dominance, it would permanently fragment global commerce and alter the strategic landscape for generations. Use this briefing to inform your situational awareness as these critical theaters continue to evolve. Thanks for listening.